I'm Greg Johnson. Merry Christmas and welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Carl Thorburn, Bitcoin Carl. Welcome back.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we are going to talk first and foremost about an article that the SPLC published recently featuring both of us. It's called How Cryptocurrency Revolutionized the White Supremacist Movement. Now, I loved this article. I thought it was fascinating. I mean, it's typical bad SPLC scholarship, and it's axe grinding, and there's all kinds of levels of dishonesty here. But it kind of paints us both in a very flattering light, don't you think?
Yeah, I was actually kind of happy with the quotes that they used from me. You know, I felt like it was a good short synopsis of, you know, generally why I'm promoting Bitcoin within the movement and why I think it's a good thing for white nationalists to get into. And, you know, so but as far as like, you know, the SPLC is concerned, obviously the article also contained sort of their attempts at guilt by association. You know, they of course, they always try to, every article has at least eight different instances of, you know, we tried to contact so-and-so, but they refused to comment or they didn't answer, you know? So it's just, it's kind of humorous in that way because nobody wants to talk to these people.
Absolutely. Well, they're liars. Frankly, if I did talk to them, I wouldn't tell them the truth. So I don't see why they even bothered to continue calling, but still. I did think the article was interesting. Let me just read some passages from it. This is the beginning. Hatewatch identified and compiled over 600 cryptocurrency addresses associated with white supremacists and other prominent far-right extremists for this essay, and then probed their transaction histories through blockchain analysis software. This is what they're doing with their $88 million annual budget. What we found is striking. White supremacists such as Greg Johnson of Countercurrents, I'm the first named person, race pseudoscience pundit Stefan Molyneux, Andrew Weave Orenheimer, and Andrew Anglin of the Daily Stormer, and Don Black of the Racist Forum Stormfront. You have to read, it's kind of breathless when you actually read it aloud, which is sort of the quality of their thinking, I think. All bought into Bitcoin early in its history and turned a substantial profit from it. Now, I just want to say, first of all, that this is completely false, as certainly as far as I'm concerned. I have never bought Bitcoin in my life, and I have never turned a profit from it. I have never paid for Bitcoin, and I never sold Bitcoin. Okay, I have given Bitcoin away. I have given Bitcoin to Weave a couple of times for good deeds that he did, but it was never payment for anything. But anyway, yeah, the idea that I bought into Bitcoin, if they mean that literally I bought Bitcoin, that's not true, and turned a profit from it, well, no, I never turned a profit from it in the sense of cashing it out. So this is just these people inventing stuff. They get little facts, 600 addresses, they run it through their software, and then they just weave together a narrative of lies and speculation, basically.
Right.
Yes. Well, go ahead.
I was going to say you're correct that what they did was they used a blockchain analysis, probably farmed it out to a corporation to try to analyze our addresses and figure out, you know, who owns what. But it's who knows how much that process cost them, because those blockchain analysis things are not cheap. So it probably cost them thousands of dollars to do this. It's entirely speculative, because when you're looking at Bitcoin blockchain, trying to figure out whose Bitcoins are whose, there's no way to know what's a donation, what's a payment to somebody else, what's just you transferring Bitcoins from one address to another that you control. So it's essentially, it's like making you know, 10,000 best guesses, and from that determining what the final result is. It's kind of like trying to forecast the weather months in advance, right? You just, there's just no way to reasonably do it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And again, we all have this prejudice, and we all have to get rid of this prejudice that when somebody's written about by some other person, even the SPLC, we have a tendency to think, well, maybe there's some truth to this. There's some kernel of truth. I have received Bitcoin as donations and occasionally as payments over the years. But what they've done is with that little seed of truth, they've grown a great big tree of speculation, basically. And I know this because I'm the guy they're talking about. And I'm pretty sure that if they are this fast and loose with facts and interpretations, in my case, they're the same with everybody else that they're talking about. And not just on Bitcoin, but on every other subject. So let's read a little further. The estimated tens of millions of dollars worth of value extreme far-right figures generated represents a sum that would almost certainly be unavailable to them without cryptocurrency, and it gave them a chance to live comfortable lives while promoting hate and authoritarianism. And then they say that Stefan Molyneux has spent $3.8 million in Bitcoin, that Weave has spent $1.07 million in Bitcoin, Anglin, $500,000, Greg Johnson, $815,200. I don't know where they get I don't know where they get any of those numbers. And they say, I received $112,400 and took out $815,000. Now, like I said, I've never cashed out any Bitcoin in my life, so I don't know what they're talking about. The interesting surprises here is that the older generation, Peter Brimlow, Don Black, Jared Taylor, they have not received a whole lot of Bitcoin. Let's continue here. There is some interesting stuff here. Johnson of Countercurrents, an influential figure in the white nationalist movement due to his outspoken support for the creation of an ethnostate serving only white non-Jewish people, first picked up Bitcoin on January 19th, 2012, Hate Watch found, making him the first known figure in the movement to invest. This is actually very flattering to me. Actually, of course, at the time, the person who pressed me to do this or pressed Countercurrents to do this was my business partner and co-founder of Countercurrents, Michael Polignano, who's a sort of tech maven. And when he told me about this, I just rolled my eyes and thought, oh, this is crazy, phony internet money. But I said, yeah, sure, why not? We have lots of people who are into crazy, phony internet fads. And so why not, right? So when they say that
you invested in it in 2012, what they really mean is that somebody happened to leave some Bitcoin for you back then, and you weren't even paying close attention to it.
Hate Watch could not determine how Johnson generated just shy of 30 Bitcoin on that Thursday in January 2012, whether he mined it or purchased it or somebody merely sent it to him, but the date falls just a year and a half after the first known commercial cryptocurrency transaction took place. Makes me sound like a real tech maven and early adopter. I have to give all credit to Mike Polignano in this case. And they do mention that at the time when I had 29.82 Bitcoin, the asset was between $5 and $10. So we're talking, $150 to $300, right? Sinister, vast.
But see, now I think what they may have done, and I might be wrong about this, but it sounds to me like what they may be doing is they might have added all this up in today's value and said, oh, this is how much money Greg Johnson has either invested into Bitcoin, which is not true at all. It's, at the time it was virtually nothing. I mean, but they try to make it sound like you were, actively trading it or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Hate Watch found that Johnson flipped the Bitcoin from that first transaction and additional ones into over $800,000 worth of value. I don't know where they're making, how they're creating these calculations. He has turned his website Countercurrents into a hub for cryptocurrency discussions in the movement and solicits donations in digital tokens or cryptocurrency coins such as Bitcoin, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Hate Watch reached out to him for a comment on this essay, but he did not respond. And as well, I shouldn't. And if I had responded, I would just told them lies anyway. But they keep asking, right? And then they quote me, if any of you haters out there have any Bitcoin and you just want to get rid of it, send it to Countercurrents. We have a Bitcoin address, Johnson said on a January 5th edition of his live stream, referring to those who perceive the cryptocurrencies lacking in real world value. Quote, I'll hold it, I'll stack it, I'll keep it. I have a huge tolerance for unreality. I don't remember saying that, but anyway, it sounds good. And folks, if you want to send it our way, send it our way. It's dipping now, so it's cheaper. Also, if you would like to help out Countercurrents right now and not with Bitcoin, you can send regular currencies through Entropy. And the address is on the bottom of the stream, entropystream.live/countercurrents. Go there, hit the green button, send us a paid chat, basically, and we will read your question or comment and thank you for your donation. Entropy Stream is the only way that we can take credit card payments. We have been deplatformed from the global credit card processing industry by angry merchants, unhappy merchants who don't like our message. And I think it's these very unhappy merchants who are probably pushing this particular line about Bitcoin. There are people who are profoundly threatened by cryptocurrency. They significantly overlap with the donor base of the SPLC. And they love to basically run down Bitcoin by saying, oh, people use Bitcoin for drug transactions and blackmail schemes, and white supremacists use it too. Of course, they don't mention that people use American dollars for blackmail schemes and drug deals and even send it to people like me. For some reason, all the dirt that the US dollar is used to affect in the world doesn't rub off on the dollar itself. It doesn't discredit the very idea of the dollar. But the fact that I take Bitcoins as donations, that somehow sullies Bitcoin. It's an obvious propaganda message put out by people who are threatened by cryptocurrency. And it should be just dismissed as that. And it's very interesting that the SPLC is doing this particular kind of shilling for the central banks, the merchants who are made unhappy by cryptocurrency, the oligarchs who are made unhappy by something they can't control.
Yeah, it's funny when you take into account the fact that everybody knows about the fact that the CIA regularly drops gigantic pallets of $100 bills onto, you know, various dictators and any insurgency that's trying to take out somebody that doesn't go along with the globalist complex. And then the funny thing about Bitcoin is it's like a they sort of know that it's not really so much about the fact that we're able to send money to each other, because we've always been able to do that. I mean, if you're even without Bitcoin, if you're really bound and determined, you can donate money to white nationalist causes. I mean, there's ways to do it outside of Bitcoin. And those ways aren't threatened. Those ways aren't being shut down. You can write a check and mail it and stuff like that. Nobody tries to shut that down. What they're trying to shut down is our ability to possess something that can't be frozen by governments and also can't be inflated. And so those are the two main threats to the system. And that's the real reason that central banks are sort of worried about Bitcoin. But see, central banks, they try to I don't know if I think that a lot of people working in central banks don't really appreciate Bitcoin's value as a uninflatable asset. What they're more interested in is its ability to be sent sort of like an email without any friction, you know, to anybody in the world, and that's something that kind of scares them. That's something that they reserve for the ruling class. You know, the ruling class is allowed to send money privately. You remember there was recently they had the Panama Papers. There was a big journalistic, it was investigative journalist figured out that a bunch of wealthy individuals from like Tony Blair and others had secret accounts in Bermuda and the Caribbean, and that they were using these to hide assets and avoid taxes and things like that. And so, you know, and of course, also the Jeffrey Epstein thing. Everybody knows at this point that these people are some of the biggest money launderers in the world because they've got the most money to launder. So really what this boils down to is that the SPLC is just angry that some people who believe in rights for white people manage to make a little bit of money, you know, and it irks them. And it's funny because it's, you know, you compare it to the amount of money that anti-whites have is, you know, literally hundreds of billions of dollars at their disposal. And, you know, it's like, you know, even if you take these numbers in the article at face value, it's like a drop in the ocean compared to what they have, you know? So it's really kvetching because they know that money is power. And if you have money, you're able to get your message out more easily. And they don't want us to have that tiny little foothold. Even just a tiny little bit of a foothold is terrifying to them because they know the message is a winning message.
Yeah, I agree. Somebody was laughing when I said that the SPLC had an $88 million budget. Actually, from their 2019 IRS Form 990, they report spending a whopping $88.43 million. If it were only $88.14 million, it would be a real joke. But anyway, they literally spent $88 million in 2019, and this is the kind of crap that they dish up. Richard Cohen, who is the president of the SPLC, pays himself nearly $400,000 a year to preside over this operation, which is basically twice Countercurrent's entire operating budget for a year.
For a single guy.
Yeah. Yeah, that just goes into his pockets. It's interesting. Let's read forward because now the story gets to you. Johnson often platforms on his site an anti-Semitic white nationalist personality who goes by the pseudonym Carl Thorburn. As Thorburn, the author advises people in the movement to purchase and hold Bitcoin as an investment. He wrote through his Telegram account that he advertises for Bitcoin so white nationalists can have money they can, quote, travel with, bad people can't seize inflate, and it will allow them to live in safer white neighborhood and start a family. Thorburn also advises people in the movement on how to donate cryptocurrency to white nationalist causes without exposing their identities, highlighting one of the key reasons that the assets appeal to them. So this is pretty good. So I'm the first known adopter of this in the movement. And on my website is a hub for people, including prominent voices like Carl Thorburn. And I'm excited by this. This is not a bad reputation to have because there are a large number of newly minted Bitcoin millionaires, multimillionaires out there. Most of them are dissidents. Not all of them. A lot of them are just normies, libertarians, but there's some of, put it this way, anybody who is an early adopter to cryptocurrency probably had significant numbers of dissident political views. Right. A lot of them were, you know, libertarians at first.
Oh yeah, I was a libertarian when I started, and in fact, I think they mentioned that in the article later on, but you know, it's funny to me they didn't mention Nick Szabo, who is a well-known pioneer of cryptocurrency. You know, he was the guy who, in my view anyway, I don't have proof of this, but in my view, he's most likely to be the creator of Bitcoin. But he's been thinking about the question of digital currency for literally since the early 80s. So, you know, if anybody has a lot of Bitcoins, it's probably going to be Nick Szabo. And he's on Twitter. You know, if you look at his Twitter account, he's frequently said pro-white things. In fact, explicitly pro-white. You know, he said he was sort of triggered by some anti-white rant that somebody had gone on. And he quote tweeted them and started to point out that he's actually quite proud of his white ancestry and heritage, and that he is wants to explore his white identity more. And so, you know, you're talking about, it's almost like we witnessed in real time, you know, somebody who's prominent in the cryptocurrency movement, who had no ties whatsoever to white nationalism prior, who was sort of red-pilled just by looking at this insolent left-winger's, you know, anti-white rant. And we witnessed it happen right before our eyes. So there's, you know, there's who knows how many examples of this where there's fairly well-to-do libertarians who just get it up to their eyeballs and with anti-white hate on Twitter. And they say, you know, why should I continue to put up with this? And why should I adhere to a set of principles that is ultimately going to result in the if not the extermination, at least the oppression of my own race. You know? So it's definitely something that's growing.
Absolutely. This libertarian to alt-right to white nationalist pipeline is a real thing. And a lot of the people coming along that pipeline are also savvy people with early cryptocurrency portfolios that are significantly growing in value. That's one reason I'm really happy to have you as part of Countercurrents. And now you've got a reputation as being part of Countercurrents from the SBLC. You know, this is going to be quoted by mainstream news sources. It'll be quoted by people testifying in front of Congress. This is great advertisement because I want you to be the guy who does peer-to-peer fundraising with all these crypto billionaires and millionaires right out there who are coming our way.
The quote is great. And the reason I love the quote is because it's like, I didn't, obviously I don't advocate anything bad, but it's like, it's funny because it's like, it's such a benign quote. It's just like, all I'm doing is I'm just saying that, you know, hey, here's potentially a pretty good way for white people to have the money to be able to get away from diversity. You know, it's not like I'm trying to say, you know, oh, you should go out and do things to harm other people or to harm, you know, non-whites. I'm just saying, no, this is how you get away from them.
Right. Exactly. And that appeals to libertarians for one thing, but exactly. You're not saying we should have Bitcoin so we can mow these suckers down, right? We should have Bitcoin so we can have nice things and live nice lives in nice white neighborhoods. It sounds, right. but to these people, that sounds sinister, right?
Yeah, yeah. Holy. That's the great thing about the SPLC and these other, like, you know, mainstream media, is that when you're sort of pre-red-pilled and you don't really think in these terms, the way they phrase things is always it always relies on enormous amounts of context and indoctrination. You know, to a normal human being who just reads this stuff, they're like, why is this bad? You know, what makes this such a sinister thing? But it only sounds sinister when you've had, you know, literally a decade plus of, you know, childhood indoctrination into thinking that white people should never be allowed to have their own spaces. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this is a pretty positive story, really, when you get right down to it. It's going to be more useful to us than it is to the SPLC. And I think this is qualifies as an own goal. I think it improves our standing in the community. I think that you and I are going to be cited a lot more, and that's going to give us more followers. And if you want to follow Carl Thorburn, follow him on Telegram. There's a scrolling thing across the bottom of the screen. He's Bitcoin Carl on Telegram, Bitcoin Carl with a K. And it's a very, very entertaining channel. Carl used to have an amazing Twitter account. It was so good they shut him down multiple times, I think. How many times did they boot you off Twitter before you finally just left for good?
I think I had a total of like 4 accounts and I finally gave up.
But yeah, you had an amazingly good Twitter takes. I really, really enjoyed following your Twitter, and I was always recommending it. And when they took you down, you would rapidly gain back a lot of followers because people just didn't passively follow you. They actively enjoyed your takes on things.
Well, I think the other thing that I actually do have another Twitter account now, and there's no telling how long until they get rid of that one, but I'm using a different pseudonym. But my thinking is that I can sort of cross-pollinate and gather some more Bitcoin fans into our movement. I think that there should be some overlap there. And there is actually a good deal of overlap that I'm not at liberty to discuss, but at least not publicly. But there are plenty of people who are only really publicly active in the Bitcoin space who are very sympathetic to our movement and our goals. And so it's a cause for optimism, a real exciting thing, because in my view, Bitcoin is something that's going to grow enormously. I mean, it's going to be a single Bitcoin in my view is going to be worth more than $1 million and in the not so distant future. And that reason alone, I think it's great that you and I are sort of front and center at the top of this SPLC article, because it's going to age well.
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree. Now, I want to shift to another topic, but folks, we will take your questions if you have questions. So go to entropystream.live/countercurrents. Also, if you want to give us your DLive tokens, your diamonds, your ice cream, your lemons, your ninja genies, we will gladly take those. We are going to cash those in at the end of the year and apply them to our fundraiser. Countercurrents is trying to raise $200,000 this year, about half of what Richard Cohen of the SPLC pays himself alone. We've gotten more than 1,100 donations at this point, and we're still tens of thousands of dollars from our goal. So if you want to help out, you can help out through Entropy or through your DLive tokens. Just toss those tokens our way. We will cash those in and we will apply them to our fundraising goal. The fundraiser ends at the end of the year, and we would dearly love to say that we got across the finish line. So I have a question here from Sutton, a longtime commentator at Countercurrents, occasional commentator, but going back very far, almost to the beginning. He wants to know about something connected with cryptocurrency that I think is most interesting. Another guy in our broad milieu, Stone Toss. Stone Toss has released what is called an NFT, a non-fungible token. He basically sold 500 images, 500 Stone Toss images on, or 5,000, I should say, 5,000 Stone Toss images in for about $400 each in Ethereum. And they sold out in about 20 minutes, netting him about $2 million.
$2 million in 20 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is amazing that one of our guys could basically do this in 20 minutes through crypto stuff. Now, it's not exactly cryptocurrency, but I would like you to explain to us what non-fungible tokens are and what this whole market is.
So let me just say, like, in this case, I think that, you know, there can be legitimate uses for a non-fungible token, and I think this is one of them. I think it's great for artists. Like, if you're an artist and you're trying to raise money, it's totally legitimate way to do it, because you're able to, it's sort of like, I'm trying to, I don't know if you remember, there was an artist named Thomas Kincaid, and yeah. He would paint, you know, sort of idyllic scenery, and a lot of people fell in love with his paintings, and he would sell the paintings, you know, in malls across America and things like that. But along with the painting would come sort of a certificate of authenticity, and he would sign it, and he would actually put a small drop of his blood on the certificate of authenticity. And NFT is sort of like that. What it is, you know, people make fun of it because they say, well, you can screenshot it, you can copy it. And that's true. You know, that's the nature of digital art, is that you can copy it. But what makes an NFT different is that it is essentially like a certificate that says that you have the original version of it, or the version that the artist considers the real version. And the token itself is what is being traded. So you can think of it sort of like it's almost like a Bitcoin, but it has a unique aspect to it that makes it different from every other token out there. So that's essentially what an NFT is. And it has the NFT token itself is not on the Bitcoin blockchain. It's a separate blockchain, but it is a blockchain nonetheless. And so it is sort of considered part of the crypto universe. Now, as far as like whether or not an NFT is a good investment for somebody to buy NFTs, I don't think they are. And, you know, there's a number of reasons for that. Like, I think that, you know, one of the things that makes Bitcoin valuable is that every Bitcoin is like every other Bitcoin. You know, that's called fungibility. You want a currency to be fungible. If a currency is not fungible, then you can have all sorts of issues with it. Like governments can start to do what's called blacklisting, where they, you know, take certain coins and they say that you're not allowed to accept these coins or receive those coins. And so an ideal currency would be totally fungible. Each token would be exactly like every other token. An NFT is not like that. It's non-fungible. So each token is distinct. And for that reason, they generally don't make good investments. But as a way to raise money for an artist, it's a great way to do it, and it's legitimate. But don't expect to, if you give an artist money that way, don't expect to make a profit on it in the future. You very likely will not.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, let's put it this way. It's non-fungible, so they're not all the same. Every FLIRC is unique, right?
Right.
But every painting is unique. And there is a market of collectible artworks, signed numbered prints, if it's a print, or just unique paintings or unique sculptures and things like that. And those do have value, and there might be significant secondary markets for some of these things.
Yeah, there could be. I'm not gonna. Yeah. I would not dispute that it's possible to resell these later on for more money. It's, you know, if you think of like the world of collectibles, it's, you know, you have there are certain fads that come and go, and but what makes something like Bitcoin more collectible, so to speak, is that it's the first of its kind. So, you know, Bitcoin being the very first cryptocurrency in existence is sort of like, it's sort of like having a Model T car, right? Even if the Model T is not exactly the best or the fastest or whatever, it's going to be the most valuable because it's supremely collectible. But yeah, I mean, you know, certainly I think that in the case of like Stone Toss and other artists who want to sell these tokens, I think it's a fantastic way for artists to raise money, because realistically, you know, let's face it, you know, a comic artist, they're generally people who live hand to mouth. You know, they don't make much money. And so the fact that he was able to make millions of dollars in 20 minutes indicates that there's enormous demand and respect for comics that are truly, what's the word, iconoclastic. You know, they're truly a part of the real dissent, not sort of fake dissent. So, you know, there's enormous market here, and that's really what the SPLC is scared of, is that they know that if we're able to not only communicate with each other, but create our own sort of subculture, then we can spread the message, but we can also help each other out financially and make people within the movement capable of supporting themselves and their art without relying on a second job at like Starbucks or something where they can get doxxed and, you know, end up with no income. So that's really the thing that scares them.
You know, when Countercurrents is out there fighting tooth and nail, Ninjagini and ice cream and diamond and lemon one at a time to get to our annual goal, it's easy to think that this movement is poor, that there's not a lot of money in this. And that probably makes Richard Cohen, who's writing checks to himself of $400,000 a year, approximately, that probably makes him feel pretty good. And it probably makes the analyst, the grind who put out this very poorly written article, Michael Edison Hayden and Megan Squire, reads like it was written by a committee. It probably makes these people feel really, really good, really, really smug. When Stone Toss can make $2 million in 20 minutes, that scares these people. That scares these people a lot, because that shows that there's actually significant amounts of money floating around in our general milieu. We just need to find the right kind of things to get people to pony up, and they will do it. So that's encouraging to us, and it's very discouraging to them. It's frightening to them. But these people, they have to know. They have to have some idea. Okay, we have this idea, and maybe we're giving them too much credit, right? Maybe we're giving them too much credit with the idea that there's a deep state, that somewhere in the bowels of Washington, there are actual adults who have actual facts, who actually know what the real world is and make decisions accordingly and are willing to kill and die to preserve the system. Maybe we're flattering them. Maybe that's just a projection of our psychology. That's what we would have if we were running a country. We would have some group of people ultimately empowered to kill and die to make the system work, and who are reality-based. They deal with facts. They don't deal with fantasies. We would do that. Does that mean that the current system does that? But let's just hypothesize that somewhere there are people in Washington who actually know the facts. If they know the facts, I think one of the facts that they know is that there are too many of us for them to stop. And I think there have been far too many of us for them to stop for a very long time. And that number has grown enormously. Just in the last year, it's grown.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's hilarious. You're talking about how much these people make. The SPLC makes enormous. So does the ADL. You know, takes in huge amounts of money. But it's so funny because it's almost like they're paid for failure, right? Because it's clearly not a job that's where you're. Compensation is based on your performance, because if you look at the last few years, ever since 2016, really, and possibly before, the number of white nationalists and white nationalist sort of adjacent sympathizers has just ballooned. It's just enormously ballooned. And if anything, these people should be paying themselves less.
Well, but this is one of the things that you find in extremely late corrupt societies. You have people writing huge checks to one another for their failures. They're too big to fail. They're insulated from any real world consequences. They think they can do this forever. Jason Kessler was just commenting about the Charlottesville lawsuit, the Sines v. Kessler suit. Sines v. Kessler was a huge failure. The main conspiracy charges, they were deadlocked. The jury would not find that there was a conspiracy. And the charges against poor James Fields, well, that was sort of a slam dunk because he admitted he was forced. He was basically extorted into pleading guilty to avoid the death penalty. So basically, they had a quote-unquote confession from him. And most of the damages were awarded in the two counts associated with him. Of course, he doesn't have the money, and his insurance company isn't on the hook for that because, well, they're on the hook for accidents. And he admitted that he did this on purpose, right? So no money will be generated from James Fields. And then there are all these laws on the books in the state of Virginia and also on the federal level that limit punitive damages. It might limit these punitive damages to a total of $135,000 for the entire trial for everybody. And in some cases, it'll be even less. So they spent more than $20 million to get this result. The poor victims, the malingerers and whiners who paraded themselves around and said that they suffered emotional damage and bad feels and things like that, most of them will get absolutely nothing from this. It just came out that Roberta Kaplan's law firm is passing out $125,000 bonuses at the end of the year. They are the only ones who made anything from this. The victims, the real and in quotes, scare quotes, victims made nothing. The evil people who were being attacked will pay nothing. Of course, they've had their lives turned upside down for 4 years and have had to pay for legal expenses. So it has hurt them. But they're not going to pay these damages. But the lawyers have made millions. They've made millions and they lost. Now, that's just a profoundly irrational system. A system that lavishly rewards people who fail is a system that is not long for this world. Eventually, it's going to be tested in a crisis. And all these people who have been paid lavishly to fail, well, the things that they put in place will fail, and the system will fail with it.
Yeah, it's I mean, the ultimate example of that, and the one that I keep talking about on my channel, is what's going on with the Federal Reserve, and really most central banks across the West, is that they are, it's just, you know, it's a constant procession of failure year after year. And we're seeing it right now. Like anytime there is the threat that the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates, even just a tiny little bit, you immediately see the collapse of the markets. And they can't let the markets collapse, because then you would have like a cascading debt jubilee situation, which would be horrific for the U.S. government, because the U.S. government is the biggest debtor out there. They're the ones with the most debt. So central banks have painted themselves in the corner. And the reason they got there, what got them there in the first place, is the fact that for decades, if you wanted to go into a career where you were not scrutinized or subjugated to performance reviews, you would go into economics. Like, you would go get a PhD in economics, and you would go work for the Federal Reserve, right? Because even if you screw up, even if your theories are all wrong and you don't make the correct moves, you still get a paycheck. And so when you have decade upon decade of, you know, experts who, well, so-called experts who think very highly of themselves, you know, they go to Princeton and Yale and Stanford, and they get PhDs in economics. They really do believe the nonsense that they peddle, and it tends to pile up over time. And it's like a forest with a bunch of dry brush at the bottom of it. I mean, eventually, you know, there's going to be a spark and it's going to start the big fire. And so that's where we are right now with the economy anyway, is that, the Fed is really screwed up there. And, you know, like you said, essentially that's the case with the legal profession now, is that, the legal profession on rare occasion, we'll see like flickers of, sense from our judicial system, but more often than not, it's from juries, right? It's like in the case of the Jussie Smollett case, and then also the Kyle Rittenhouse. And, there's a few rare cases like that where the good guys win. But, the U.S. has just had decades where you've got people who really don't face any sort of scrutiny, and they think very, very highly of themselves. And so, and I think we might even be seeing this too in like the military. You know, the military is starting to realize, it turns out that China has greater capabilities than we do in many areas, and yet their military budget is like what, half, maybe less than half of the U.S. military budget. So yeah, they're just paying themselves. They're paying themselves for mediocrity, is what it is.
Well, I think the U.S. military budget is actually bigger than the military budgets of every other country in the world combined. It's quite remarkable how much money is being shoveled into this, gaping maw at the Pentagon, and a lot of it's going for diversity programs now. Leftists believe that the military is a place where transsexuals and lesbians anybody with any kind of Tumblrite identity can now go to find him or her or itself. It's just a playground for misfits, basically.
Oh yeah, the military is it's become like the Boy Scouts for the gender non-binary.
That's good. I like that. So let's go over to Entropy and see some of the questions we've got here. We've got some very good questions. So I want to begin by thanking RC. RC wrote in and he says, hope you make your $200,000 goal, and he gives $100. Thank you very much. I very much appreciate that. I hope we make it too, and you got us $100 closer, so I appreciate it. Is S sent $52. Thank you. David sent $6. Thank you. Jeremy sent $29. We appreciate it. Hortator sent €100. That's most generous. Over recent years, it is becoming very apparent that corporations don't just see themselves as places of business to earn money for their owners and pay wages to employees, but are increasingly determined to drive cultural change in a woke, global, and profoundly abnormal direction. How aware are the general public, if at all? Are there things we can do to combat it? What can we do to combat the woke corporation? Do you have any thoughts on this, Carl?
Well, I think that you can't go wrong by taking an anti-corporate position generally. And also, I think that another position that we should be advocating loudly is for privacy also, because privacy is something that the corporations routinely violate. And everybody walking around, no matter what their political views really, except for just absolutely marginal weird people, they sort of implicitly or sort of inherently understand the value of privacy to human condition and sort of development, right? And I think that that's privacy is essentially violations of privacy is how corporations and governments control dissidents, right? Because they are, you have the NSA and FBI and people like that are, continually doing things to violate privacy. But I think if you want to stop woke, I mean, really the best way to do it is to mock it, I guess, comedy like Stone Toss does is really the most effective and most powerful. And the reason it's the most effective is because that's how anti-whites and anti-Christians broke down Western identity, you know, over the years, is that it took many, many years of mockery and comedy to do it, but they eventually did it. So I, you know, as far as woke goes, I think we're, you know, we're on the right track, on the right path, but we still need more entertainment. I feel like, you know, I talk to people privately who are very interested in the idea of having more skit comedy and things like that. I think that Stone Toss is a great start, but I think that we should have live action comedy and entertainment, like cartoons and you know, things like that would be good.
Yeah, those are good thoughts. I think that corporations are profoundly amoral entities for the most part. There was a documentary I saw years ago on corporations where they basically laid out the personality profile of a corporation. If a corporation were a human being, and of course it's a legal person, but if it were a human being, it has a certain personality profile, and the personality profile of the corporation is basically the sociopath. They're very dangerous institutions, and this is why we used to have regulation. We had regulation to try and basically trim the claws of the corporations, make them into good citizens, try and make them into good, make them boons to the public rather than threats. Right. We used to have things like socialist parties. We used to have things like revolutions where oligarchs would get put to death.
Right.
But they've managed to short circuit all of those things.
Well, it's like the question is, who is cultivating who, right? You know, the problem is that corporations treat their customers and people generally as something to be farmed and sort of cultivated and grown, right? And so that's the problem is that we need to be the ones that cultivate the corporations. Don't let them.
Yeah, they're not threatened by the left anymore. They own the left. They are the left. They are not threatened by regulation anymore. They have basically captured the regulatory apparatuses in Western societies. It occurred to me today, and this is profoundly disturbing because it's so dystopian. It occurred to me that a significant percentage of what's going on with COVID, the way governments are reacting to COVID, may simply be due to the fact that governments have no agenda anymore. There are no real deciders in government. There is no real sovereignty. Power and policy is just auctioned off in basically a marketplace, which is what liberalism is. Liberalism is just making everything private. And that means that you even make the legislative and regulatory process a marketplace that is dominated by private interests. And the people of the biggest bucks get the policies. They buy the policies. COVID policies, where we are now getting propaganda to vaccinate children for a disease that doesn't threaten children and doesn't kill children, may simply be dictated by the fact that Big Pharma wants big profits. They have absolutely no compunction about killing people with addictive drugs. We certainly saw that with the with the opioid crisis. Or just giving people useless things that don't kill them but might have serious long-term side effects. Who knows? These people have no compunctions about that. These corporations are utterly sociopathic. The regulatory apparatus that's supposed to rein them in has been bought by them and controlled by them. Corporations now control Congress, basically. Pharmaceutical corporations are massive lobbyists. Their advertising dollar goes extremely far. A huge amount of cable news is Big Pharma ads. If you spend an hour watching that kind of stuff,
isn't that ironic? You know, I remember seeing people in various, you know, European countries sort of making fun of America and Americans for tolerating all of these drug company ads on our television. But it's like, you know, in Europe, they're some of the ones that are pushing the, you know, I think the president of the EU recently said that she was looking into compulsory vaccination there. And, you know, of course, that's going to mean boosters also endlessly. So it's a funny turnabout. You know, it's like, well, apparently the ads in the U.S. didn't have much of an effect, because as far as I know, I think Americans might even be more against compulsory vaccination than most European nations.
Yeah, absolutely. But it could be the case. It could be the case that because there are no serious forces anymore, that there are no serious men in politics, there are no serious issues, there are no serious ideologies, except us, of course. But in the mainstream of politics, there are no serious forces, and therefore pure commerce can actually dictate these things. You know, Marxism is profoundly wrong, because ultimately, in the final instance, human beings are not motivated by money. They're motivated by ideas. They're motivated by forms of idealism. But the whole end of history idea is the bourgeois world is a world where basically everything is just commercial. And we have so commercialized politics that it might simply be the case that, something as banal as the greed of utterly sociopathic corporations could be the only factor driving public policy, public health policy. That and the narcissism of egomaniacs like Fauci. One thing that is profoundly disturbing to me is this Fauci character has a long history, decades-long history, of popping up and promoting big scares, followed by campaigns to vaccinate people for various things. We know this is how he feels important. This is how he gets rich. This is how he gets his narcissistic supply. This is how he can play the hero when there are these crises. And now we know that he was the guy paying for the gain of function research in Wuhan that created the COVID epidemic. Now, I'm sure a lot of generous minded people would just like to say, oh, this is just a ghastly mistake, and what a strange coincidence. I urge you to look up Munchausen by proxy. Munchausen by proxy is a psychological ailment. I suppose you could call it an ailment. It's a psychological pathology. Let's put it that way. In which women, and it's almost always women, I think it's entirely women, frankly, in which women, mothers, will make their children sick in order to gain attention and feel powerful. It's a form of narcissism. It's a form of enabling behavior. It's akin to the codependent enabler. The codependent enabler loves to help, in quotes, people who are dependent because it's an ego trip. Well, the next step is to make people more dependent so you can have the ego trip. This is how people start hoarding pets and things like that. There's a lot that can be explained about policies towards migrants and non-whites in terms of the psychology of the pet hoarding, basically enabler. These people are on ego trips. Is it at least conceivable that somebody like Fauci could have actively cooked up the Wuhan plague, because this is the kind of thing that gets him back in the spotlight, gets him famous? If women are willing to poison their own children for sympathy and attention, then it's completely conceivable that this egomaniac could have actually cooked this thing up. So he can be the center of everybody's attention. The possibility that world history is being shaped by utterly petty people, utterly petty and sick people like this, is really kind of frightening. But this is sort of the post-historical utopia that liberal progressives have been claiming is upon us, where, you know, we're free of all the big issues. Well, if we're free of all the big issues, then what runs the world? Pettiness, petty issues. So anyway, I think it's a disturbing possibility.
I think that's a good way to look at it. Like, I think that we're coming up on a point where people, I don't want to exactly use the phrase they're getting bored of democracy, but it's almost like that. It's like, I think people are kind of realizing that there's more to life and there's more to living than, this TikTok back and forth of Republican Democrat consume. You know, it's just, people want something that's a little bit more profound, a little bit deeper. And, you know, in the past they would have gotten that from religion. For the last, 40, 50 years, they've gotten it from technological progress. There's been, I think actually that's one of the big reasons for the spread of insufferable internet atheists. Atheism spread because it was able to sort of latch on to this idea that eventually we'll reach a Jetsons utopia, and that was sort of like their version of heaven. So you can understand that would appeal to a lot of people and that would become their profound driving force. But the problem is that we're, I think recently and especially in the next, several years, it's going to become more apparent to more people, especially smarter people, that we're actually heading downhill. We're not heading toward Jetsons. We're heading toward South Africa.
Absolutely.
Something. And so when that becomes more apparent and more obvious, I think people are going to start reaching for bigger answers. You know, they're going to start looking in places that they haven't looked before. And so that's why I don't think it's sustainable for much longer.
Yeah, I agree. It's not sustainable because, we're not satisfied merely with satisfying ourselves. There's more to the human soul than this. And a lot of the pathologies that we see in culture are basically due to the fact that we're not getting what we really need. You can never get enough of what you don't really need, Eric Hoffer said. And this is basically why consumerism leads to this frenzy of empty consumption, because if it's not sustaining you, if it's not nourishing you, if it's not satisfying you, then you can't get enough of it, right? If we were getting what we need, there would be immediate cessation in the sort of frenzy of pursuing stuff. Again, you can never get enough of what you don't really need. I think it's quite profound. Let's go over to our friends at DLive who have been giving us tokens. Flynn Photo has donated one ice cream and four lemons. Take that, SPLC. Slog has donated 14 lemons. I hope you're taking this down, Michael Edison Hayden. White Rabbit Radio has donated one diamond. Go Thorburn. Merry Christmas to all of you. Thank you, and Merry Christmas to you, White Rabbit. Ninja Warrior has donated one diamond. SPLC, Greg Johnson is actually Satoshi Nakamoto. No, but I know who Satoshi Nakamoto is. White Coats are coming. Just donated five lemons. Thank you very much. I very much appreciate that. Over at Entropy, we have $100 from Jasper. Very generous. One thing our favorite tribe has taught us is that even a tiny dedicated minority can wield tremendous power and influence, but none of that would have been possible without their wealth. Crypto is an exotic asset to diversify a portfolio, but it won't make most investors rich. Before dabbling in crypto, everyone should understand the basics of financial management. And he also adds another $50. Building and protecting our personal wealth is the first step in expanding our influence and strengthening our network. It makes us less vulnerable to doxing. For the sake of the movement, each of us should learn the fundamentals of saving and investing. Two great books are The White Coat Investor and Bogglehead's Guide to Investing. That is very good advice. And one of the things that I want to publish in the next year or two is not by me, but I will publish it. I want to get a book that's just the basics of financial planning and investment for white people. Of course, the lessons can be used by everybody, but I want to brand it for and get it out to our community because I want our community to be stronger. I want our community to have an edge over other groups because we live in a world of ethnic competition. We live in a world where there is systematic white disprivilege, where white people therefore need to pull together and we need to be serious. We don't have time to be silly anymore.
I was going to say, you know, Jews are to finance what blacks are to basketball. It's sort of like their sport. It's what they're good at, and they treat it competitively like it's a sport. And I see no reason that we can't also do that. Like, there's really no reason that pro-whites can't become good at building businesses, investing. And, you know, he's right. It doesn't, you know, it's not 100% Bitcoin, right? You know, you can, Bitcoin, in my view, it's a great, great starting point. But eventually, you know, it's going to meet its fair value. And at that point, you need to know how to deal with money in other ways. You know, you need to know how to diversify later on.
Yeah, that's a very good point. We all need to be smart about money. And there are basic rules that we should all know and follow. There are things that my parents didn't teach me. They taught me a few things that I very much benefited from and value, but I wish they taught me more. I kind of think that our racial enemies probably learn a lot of this stuff at the breakfast table when they're kids. And we should, without being petty and vulgar about it, but still be serious about it, right? There's a difference between making money your God, which is a very vulgar and an ugly thing, and just treating money seriously. It's not going to make you happy. It's not the be all and end all, but it's an extremely important tool that should be taken seriously. And we should not have a happy-go-lucky attitude toward it. Go ahead.
As far as like donating to fellow nationalists, absolutely. You should always feel good about doing that because keep in mind that, for every $1 you donate to a nationalist that produces content, that's, you know, quality pro-white content, that's like $1,000 in the SPLC or the ADL, right? The impact of that $1 goes way, way further than it would for our enemies. And so it's, you know, you should always feel good about giving money.
Yeah, I like that. That's a great message. We looked at SimilarWeb for last month. And according to SimilarWeb, Countercurrents had 640,480 page views in November. And we decided to put that in perspective. So we compared Countercurrents to TalkieMag. TalkieMag had 530,000. So we had more than 110,000 above TalkieMag. We were 21% ahead of TalkieMag. We compared ourselves to VDare. VDare had 385,000. So we were 66% above VDare in terms of page views. I compared us to American Renaissance. American Renaissance had 714,000. So they were 10% ahead of us. That's very good. I looked at Chronicles magazine that's being run now by Paul Gottfried. It's the paleocon intellectual cultural journal. Chronicles has a website and they had 268,000 page views, less than half. We were 139% ahead of them. And then we looked at Hate Watch, the SPLC. In November of 2021, They had 804,000 page views. We had 640,000. So they were 20% ahead of us. Now, they have a budget of $88 million a year. We have a budget of a couple hundred thousand dollars a year, we hope. And yet we manage to garner 80% as much traffic as they do with a tiny fraction of what of the resources that they have. That I think is really quite telling, and it's basis for hope. Our enemies are investing absolutely enormous amounts of money, $25 million just in the lawfare against a bunch of people who don't have very much money over the Sines v. Kessler case. $25 million was shaken loose to harass people. $88 million was spent by the SPLC in 2019. And what do they have to show for it? They're losing, right? One of my favorite comments on social media, I wish I knew who said it, the account's probably long gone. After Hillary Clinton was defeated, it was something to the effect that it must feel terrible to have academia and big business and the media on your side, like Hillary did, and still lose. You know, these people have enormous amounts of money on their side, and they still lose. I think that we have very little money, and we're winning. We're doing well.
Yeah, something tells me they're not going to put that quote from you in the next SPLC article.
Yeah, absolutely not. But they know what side their bread is buttered on. So let's look at some more questions here at Entropy. Scott writes in with $20. Richard Spencer is not much of a thinker, but he does have a talent for gaining people's confidence. For instance, he was appointed editor in chief at Talkie Mag, despite having no editorial experience and no published work. He assembled an impressive group of writers for his alt-right website. How is he able to do this? Well, he did have a job as an assistant editor for a while at the American Conservative and got fired from that job after a few months. And then he went and got his job at Talkie Mag, and he was there for a year or two. Talkie said that the website was sort of flat during his time, and then it only really took off after he left. He managed to get some money for starting the alt-right site in 2010 after he left Talkie Mag. What was the secret to his success? Well, you know, he was presentable. He was polished. He wore nice ties and things like that. And he was young. And when you're a young guy and you dress well, and you've got good credentials and good breeding and things like that, people are willing to take a chance on you. And that's basically it. Also, there are just very few people like him showed up in our milieu. And so they thought that he would be a real asset. He had promise. He had potential.
Yeah,
that was it.
I think he... That was a learning experience, right? For a lot of people. I think that people gave him the benefit of the doubt and, you know, gave him opportunities to make mistakes, which is fine. But the problem is that he consistently made bad choices, and you can only do that so much before people start to learn to avoid you.
Yeah. You see, when you're young, you have a lot of potential. And people, when they're young, get jobs based on guesses about their potential. And of course, there are certain cues that you have, things that you use, heuristics, you know, their background and things like that, their educational level, et cetera. As time goes on, though, you're judged more by your performance than by your potential, by what's actual rather than potential. And of course, there's a bell curve here. Some people learn more slowly than others based on people's performance. But eventually, most people who associated with him just sort of decided, well, I just don't see much point in continuing with this relationship. And so at least 109 people have finally broken their relationships with them.
Well, you know, it's also that he has a lot of disdain for the grassroots, I think. You know, he speaks in really derogatory terms about a lot of the people that look up to him and like him. And you can't do that too much without eventually losing followers. You know, like he,
you know, yeah,
that's just, he's a little bit too elitist.
Yeah. Yeah. So Scott continues with another 10 US dollars. If I didn't know where Richard Spencer was from, I guess would be, wouldn't be Texas. He has a weird way of modulating his voice. He sounds like an actor reciting lines in high school rendition of Shakespeare. Why do you think he does that? Does he think it makes him sound cultivated? Well, I don't know exactly. I do know this, that he was a drama major at first. So, yeah, I think there's something kind of contrived and manicured about the way that he presents himself. Yeah, so Scott also asks, sends another 10 US dollars with another question. Also on Spencer, I found it odd that Spencer went to Germany in 2003 or 2004 and perceived it as an ethnostate. His old mentor, Paul Gottfried, says that Germany is a nation plagued by guilt and that Germans are a deeply self-loathing people. How could these two people have entirely opposite impressions of Germany? I think they probably were just talking about different aspects of it. That's the most charitable interpretation. In certain ways, compared to the United States, even in its most self-loathing present fallen condition, Germany is still much more of an ethnostate than the United States is today. So maybe that explains it.
People get defensive of their home country when it's being critiqued by a foreigner. But when they're critiquing their own country among themselves, they tend to be really down on it. So that might have been the other thing, was maybe that maybe Paul Gottfried was critiquing Germany, you know, within his own circle of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's look at Mastercraft Mainframe has sent 50 US dollars. Very generous. Thank you. With the decline of the global American empire certain, what state should we be building? I have been mulling over the benefits, drawbacks of an aristocratic monarchy with a focus on traditional Christian ethics. Ideas? So let's begin with you, Carl. What are your thoughts on this?
This is really tough, but I think that what I would do is simply, I think that going straight from what we have now to an aristocratic monarchy would be probably not stable. I think the reason for that is because people have become so accustomed to democracy that it's probably best to have a type of democracy with maybe a very weak monarch who's just sort of given like veto rights. Liechtenstein has something like this. I really like Liechtenstein's system. Basically, they have direct democracy for many questions. And then if the, you know, I think recently the people of Liechtenstein actually voted to legalize abortion and the monarch vetoed it. So as a monarch, he, you know, he has the ability to deny democratic determinations. But I think that's probably the best way to go. I would maintain some element of democracy, but I would limit voting rights to I would limit it to select few in the same way that the founding fathers of the U.S. did. I would try to make voting kind of a prestigious thing.
Yeah, I am not a particular fan of monarchy. I tend to incline towards a republic as a form of political order. And yet at the same time, I think monarchies over time have become humanized and softened, and the edges has been taken off them, and they've become patriotic to some extent. We have to recognize, though, that for a very long period of time, Europe was ruled by these aristocratic and monarchical families that basically felt almost zero connection to the people they ruled over. There were peoples, definitely. There were the French and there were the Germans. Their political orders didn't really represent them. The people weren't sovereign. Countries were passed back and forth in dowries, basically, and are passed back and forth as contests and wars between aristocrats and monarchs. That's a crazy way of running a society. It was akin to modern globalism, where you have elites that have almost no connection to the societies that they live in, that have more connection to one another than they do to the people in their own societies today, people who share the same citizenship with them. That's not a good form of government. I honestly like things like... This will be misunderstood, but there's a lot to be said for the French Revolution. When you look at the French Revolution really was one of the things that popularized the idea that the people need to be sovereign. The people, as an ethnic group, need to be sovereign. It's not kings who are sovereign, it's the people. And how do you define the people? Well, ultimately, the most natural definition of a people is a people who are related to one another by blood and speak the same language and share the same history. And so that really was an idea that was long dormant, right? There were peoples, but the idea of the sovereignty of peoples was long suppressed in Europe by these monarchy, basically. And it's not a good way of running things. So I'm not a great fan of monarchy, even though it's got a certain glamour. I like the idea of the sovereignty of the people. Now, if monarchs will go along with that, if they recognize that it's the people who are sovereign, not them, and that they are basically executives and incarnations of the people, there to serve their interests. Now, that's a fine system. If monarchy can be tamed and transformed into something like an executive, then I think that's not a bad system. The best system of government, frankly, is the so-called mixed regime. This is a form of government that emerged quite spontaneously around the Mediterranean, in the various Greek city-states, in ancient Rome, and so forth, where you had three elements to the government. You had representation of the masses, of the many, popular representation. You had representation of the elites, an aristocratic element. And you also had a monarchical element, a person who was basically a military commander and a decider in emergency situations. And Aristotle in his Politics talks about the rationale for a mixed regime. He argues that if you have a pure aristocracy, a pure monarchy, a pure democracy, or pure popular government, that these too easily slide into corrupt and unjust forms. Whereas if you empower the people and the elites and the decider, the military commander, the guy who has to step in times of emergency and dictate, and they all exist in the same system and they can check and balance one another, you are more likely to have a system that hits on the common good of society. And so he was the first person to really theorize the desirability of having a mixed regime. And the best constitutions in history have been mixed regimes. And now the way that you select the monarchical element, could be hereditary monarchy, or it could be an elected president or something else. There are different ways of doing that. But the best monarchies have also been combined with legislatures, parliaments, including aristocratic and popular houses. I'm thinking of the British system, for instance. The American system is a mixed regime with a monarchical element in the person of the president, aristocratic elements in the form of the courts and the Senate, and a popular element in the form of the House of Representatives. So I think we don't have to create anything radically new or contemplate anything radically new. We simply can look back to things that worked in the past. And I think that there's a lot to be said for the mixed regime. And the original American system was a mixed regime. We would definitely want to purge it and reform it dramatically because it's been terribly corrupted. And the best thing we could do is reduce the franchise, cut back the number of people who can vote. That would increase the quality of decision making. But you still want to give some power to the people. If you don't give power to the people, you get corruption. Yeah, you get elites running amok and running society into the ground. You can argue that the reason why we have such out-of-touch, corrupt elites today is that the people aren't empowered enough. The enemy has found a way of corrupting democracy and turning democracy into a farce. This is what multi-party, two-party democracy in America is. It's a farce. It's a farce. Where they have, again, I've said this many times, they've made an art of not giving the people what they want while having the people vote constantly every couple of years, right? You go and you vote and magically you don't get what you want again and again and again. That's a system that needs to be purged, but it needs to be purged to make it more democratic in the sense of more responsive to the votes of the people. Honestly, radical direct democracy in America today, where people could vote on things like capital punishment or immigration policy or whatever with their cell phones, would produce better decisions than the representative deliberative democracy that we've got today. Sad to say.
Yeah. I saw a video yesterday. I think it was on the New York Times YouTube channel. And there was actually a reporter who compiled some good data on the rankings of the 50 states based upon how well they comport with the Democratic National Committee's party platform. And surprisingly, some of the worst states in the union, as far as like the Democrat policy is concerned, were actually states that where Democrats are in full control. You know, they have the House, the Senate, the legislature, and the governorship of the state. And yet the tax system then the state is heavily skewed to benefit billionaires or millionaires. So it's clear at this point that democracy is sort of, I wouldn't say it's corrupted. It's just completely separated from the people, and a more direct system would definitely be better.
Yeah, so let's look at entropy again. Bartleby writes in, less than 3 weeks to go, support countercurrents, and he gives $50. That's the way to do it. Thank you. Gaddius writes in with $40. Carl, off the top of your head, what is the best step-by-step guide to get our guys and gals into stacking sats, Bitcoin, Satoshis? I guess that's what he's saying.
I would have to think about this. I think that really the best way to approach it with people is to explain to them the potential market size, because, Bitcoin is not like investing in Apple or something, right? Now, surely Apple, owning shares of Apple is not necessarily a bad thing. Apple being the biggest company in the world could still probably has room to grow. The question is, though, is how much can it grow? And I think compared to Bitcoin, most investments out there just don't even come close. So I would start off by pointing out, I would say, you know, get people excited about it because of the potential size of it being a global currency and a global store of value that's really tiny right now. It's still tiny. And the other thing I would say is, you know, just even if you don't think that you could get a whole Bitcoin, or if you don't think that you could, you know, necessarily get rich off of it, you know, that shouldn't be your goal with investing, right? Your goal with investing is to make yourself more financially comfortable. And if you're only trying to get rich, then, you know, just go buy a lottery ticket or something, right? Like, you know, your risk to reward ratio is not nearly as good, but you could potentially become worth hundreds of millions, but it's stupid, right? It's dumb. That's the way, you know, sort of investing in something like a Dogecoin or Shiba coin or whatever, all these tiny altcoins, they're more akin to investing in a lottery ticket. So yeah, as stacking Bitcoins goes, it's sort of in a weird middle position right now, because it's like, it's not exactly the most exciting investment in that it's not like a lottery ticket, but it's still way more outside of the mainstream than investing in stocks or you know, something like Apple or something. So yeah, it's kind of is straddling the fence as far as risk goes at this stage of the game. So you have to sort of tailor your message to the individual person, figure out what is their goal. I mean, is their goal to you know, take on an enormous amount of risk? In that case, they're going to get bored with Bitcoin. You know, despite the fact that I still expect Bitcoin to go up, you know, huge amounts. Those types of people are going to be the ones that dump it when it goes down. You know, they're going to get scared. So it takes a certain type of person to have the patience to accumulate this stuff. But yeah, I'd have to give this more thought. Like, I mean, there probably is, I'm sure other people have done it, and I need to find good examples and link you guys to it, because there are ways to get people interested.
All righty. So back to Entropy Unknown Californian. Sends $5. I want to wish everyone at Countercurrents a Merry Christmas and a Happy Yule. I always enjoy listening to Greg. I have mad respect and love in my heart for everything you do, Greg. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. Horatio Nelson writes in with $25. How correlated is the price of Bitcoin to the price of energy? It seems to me that transaction fees in dollars are spread out and have a lot of small subsidies throughout the economy. But with Bitcoin, it will be more directly evident. More transparency may be useful in the long run, but maybe not in the short run. What are your thoughts on that?
The only reason Bitcoin would be correlated to energy is because of inflation. So if the price of energy, the price of electricity, goes up in the short run, it's probably due to inflation or a booming economy, right? When you have a booming economy, not only do you have inflation, but you also have greater demand for electricity generally, because people use electricity to run factories and you know, keep shops open and things like that. During a recession, when there's a crash, you see energy prices plummet also. And so the reason is, you know, like I said, because the amount of electricity that a recessionary economy is using is going to be far less. And so the, you know, price of gas and oil and coal and everything else like that is going to be plummeting also. So yeah, that's the reason it would be correlated. It would not be correlated due to mining. So mining Bitcoin, it's funny, I actually noticed this today. Today was the first day officially that Bitcoin's hash rate, meaning the amount of electricity that miners use, actually exceeds its previous all-time high, which was several months ago, back before China banned it. So when China banned Bitcoin earlier this year, that's when it crashed significantly. I think it went from like 64,000 down to 29,000. And anyway, here we are today. We went up again to 66,000, or actually, no, I take that back. It was 69,000 at the peak, and now it's down to like 40, I forgot what it was. I think it's 44,000, 45, something like that. But it, despite that, it still has the highest hash rate ever. And so that indicates that miners are very optimistic about the future of Bitcoin, or at least the near term to medium term future of it, because otherwise they wouldn't be dumping so much electricity into mining it. So that's a good sort of a good insider indicator. It's almost similar to like seeing insiders buy shares of their own stock. If you see the CEO of a company buying more shares of his own company, then that's probably a good sign that it's going to go up in the near future. But yeah, that's why it would correlate with energy.
That's interesting. One of the things that really causes me to laugh is the concern trolling about Bitcoin and electricity. Oh, it's using too much energy. I just have to die. This is another thing that the unhappy merchants who don't like Bitcoin are desperately trying to put out there as a meme.
And
bad for the environment.
Yeah, what's hilarious is that we even saw the government of, or I don't think it was an official within the government. There was some organization within the government of Sweden actually said that they wanted to ban Bitcoin mining in Sweden, even if the miners were using renewable energy. So it's like, it wasn't enough to just ban it, for non-renewables. They had to ban it for essentially green energy. And so that indicates that, and you know, their rationale anyway, their excuse was that, well, that energy could be used for something else. And it's like, but what else? I mean,
yeah,
the reason people mine Bitcoin is because the electricity that's going to mine that has essentially no other use case. It's what's called stranded electricity. It's sort of there for the taking. It's kind of like if you had a waterfall in your backyard, and these people would come and say, well, you can't attach an electric generator to that waterfall because that would be wasting electricity. You know, it's just asinine.
Yeah. Yeah. Not attaching a generator to the waterfall is wasting the electricity when you get right down to it. Yeah. The idea that people like Elizabeth Warren are going to be clucking and fretting about the energy used by Bitcoin, and then somebody like Elon Musk pretends to take this seriously, is just disgusting. If we want to talk about regulating industries based on their use of electricity, let's look at the porn industry. Let's see how much electricity is used by the porn industry. That'd be very, very interesting.
Actually, you know, that's totally doable. Yeah, you could, in theory, figure out what you would have to do is you'd have to figure out which how much traffic is going to the porn sites, and you'd also have to figure out the servers, like what servers they own. But it's probably for an investigative journalist, they could probably calculate that in a few days.
Yeah. But of course, then we'd realize that no, it really wasn't about the electricity. And the fact that they said, well, even if it's green energy, we shouldn't allow it, means, well, it's not about energy anyway, then, is it? It's about some other agenda. They're always looking for excuses to do this. And it's very depressing when you finally realize that people in power are willing to just lie to get what they want, that they are willing to look you in the face and lie. And if that lie doesn't work, they'll come up with another lie on the spot. And they just keep doing this. This is the system. And yet we pretend that they're gentlemen, and we pretend that we can live with these people. And more people are realizing, no, we can't, and pretending doesn't make it any better.
Yeah. Well, so, the thin veneer is getting thinner. I mean, it's just like, you know, years ago. Now, see, then again, this was before I was, you know, quote unquote red pilled, but I don't really remember it being. I don't remember their lies being this blatantly obvious. it's gotten a lot worse, I feel like.
Yeah. Well, I think it's because they're getting desperate, and this is good because the more the establishment, especially the media, has almost no credibility anymore. Its credibility is in absolute free fall, and I think that's very, very encouraging. So let's look over at our friends at DLive and see if we've got any more tokens. Folks, we need some more lemons and diamonds and ice cream over at DLive. We're running out. We seem to have caught up with all the questions over at Entropy, and we seem to have caught up with all the questions at DLive. I have a question that was emailed to me by Edwina. Edwina wants to know our take on the recent Patriot Front rally in Washington, D.C. What are your thoughts on this, Carl?
Honestly, I didn't pay that close attention to it. I know sort of superficially what they were there, you know, doing. It appeared they were marching with American flags. And my main criticism of it, you know, aside from I saw a lot of people criticizing them for having masks on or for being too fit, like they weren't obese or something. I mean, you know, I think it's possible that some of them were feds, but ultimately it shouldn't matter that much. The question is, what are they promoting? Like, what is it? What's their message? I didn't really get that. If they had been carrying a banner that was like, you know, said, you know, charge Daryl Brooks with hate crime, right? Or I don't know, something that was actionable, that was pro-white, I would be much more sympathetic to it. I feel it was sort of just a kind of a show of power, I guess. I don't know. I don't know exactly what their goal was.
I do think you made a valid point. It's hard to know what their message was just from seeing them marching. I was not, how to put it, I am not a big supporter of marches and things like that, just because I think that, it's hard for us to control physical space in America today. It's not really a battle that we can easily win. However, I do think it's worth trying, and I do think that it's worth coming up with new strategies for doing this kind of stuff. The main message that I got out of this was not what they stood for, but it was simply how it triggered responses in the system. And I thought that was very interesting. And the responses from the people on the right were especially interesting. The claims of there must be feds, they're not fat. I thought that was extremely funny. It was a real own goal, right, for people to say, well, these can't be real right wingers because they're not fat.
If they attended Ambrin, they would see that there's not that many fat people there.
Yeah. The assumption is that anybody who's fit can't be legit. It's totally absurd. I think it's I think it's quite funny.
That would be a great bumper sticker.
I remember there was this free speech rally, and there was this picture of a bunch of, you know, 30-something guys who were all very fit, sort of standing around talking with one another. And this was all over social media. Hello, fellow patriots. You know, it's just people just immediately framed these people as federal informants and infiltrators. And I thought that was not merited entirely. I think it's based on a prejudice that anybody who's in good shape couldn't be legit. They must be cops or something like that. I think the ethos in our movement, aside from trad worker, which was sort of a fat acceptance outfit, for the most part, is towards being fit and presentable in public. It's definitely the case with Identity Europa. It's definitely the case with AIM, now defunct as well. And it's definitely the case with Patriot Front. I think that's good. It's good to have standards and aesthetic. I don't know what they stand for. I don't know what they hope to gain. But they did gain a lot by simply triggering the system and triggering the MAGAtards, triggering the right, triggering a lot of people.
That is interesting, though. It's kind of strange that all those alt-light types got scared by this march when I didn't really see any indication or evidence that they were anything beyond alt-light. Like, you know, it's not like they were explicitly saying white nationalist things during the march.
No. They were carrying American flags. It was red, white, and blue. Now, I think Patriot Front was using the fasces earlier. I don't know that much about the group, but that's actually kind of a good thing. They seem to have actual OPSEC. They also seem to manage the social media aspect of this extremely well. They were quite clever about that. I have to give these people praise. It was well done. The Antifa didn't know about it. They didn't show up and try and break it up. They were disciplined. They didn't have outsiders there basically photobombing them, carrying the wrong flag or looking out of place or whatever. So I appreciate that. I think that that all shows signs of intelligence. I'm not sure what their aim is. But again, that's not such a bad thing because that shows OPSEC too. So my sense about this is that it's good to see people evolving and trying to figure out ways of doing public activism, including the march, the demo, in extremely hostile times. It would be nice to think that Antifa doesn't own the streets of America forever, or BLM doesn't own the streets of America forever. These people melted down over this. You know that these people in New York and DC saw these people and they didn't even have the sound up, but you know that they were hallucinating the sound effect of marching feet. You know, it scared them. Fine. I kind of like the fact that that scares and triggers them. It's
yeah. Yeah. I mean, reclamation of space is, it really, pisses off our enemies. And, you know, so even if you don't think that, it's that important in the grand scheme of things, just the mere fact that anti-whites hate it so much to see confident, fit white guys marching around side by side, that in and of itself makes it worth doing, I guess.
Yeah. After Charlottesville, I said that there was a general consensus forming amongst people who were, I don't know, honest about what had happened, that it was not tactically a very good thing to have an event where you announce it months in advance and allow the enemy to form counter plans, or where you do it in a city that's controlled by the enemy. Of course, this was Washington, D.C., the heart of the enemy, and where you basically let anybody show up and march with you, because that allows people to come in and photobomb you. And just, you know, hijack your message. You want to have events like the identitarians in Europe do, where it's a disciplined crew of people that are on the same message, that have contingency plans in place for various outcomes, who are careful about OPSEC and things like that. They get in, they get out, they make their point, they do their own news coverage and try and control the message as much as possible. This is the way forward for activism.
Well, I also love the idea of people who march having some sort of easy identification that makes it so that you can immediately tell if there's a infiltrator, right? You could pass out, some kind of a bandana or something like that, that only the known participants can have access to at the last minute. And that way anybody infiltrating, can't blend in.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that was most depressing to me about watching videos of Unite the Right, and I watched a lot of video streams that went up on YouTube of Unite the Right, it was how depressing it was when you had these melees and you couldn't tell our guys from the Antifa. It's like, what side is this now? They all looked pretty scruffy and marginal, right? You couldn't really tell who was who in a lot of places. That wasn't good. You want clear lines, and you especially want that so that the enemy can't just march up to you or saunter up and say, hey, fellow patriots, right? You want to know who's an outsider and who's an insider. But yeah, the point that I was making is that the future of outdoor activism is going to be in America more like identitarian activism and less like Unite the Right. Now, I thought the Patriot Front's event recently and also the thing they did in Philadelphia is more like what the identitarians do. It was well planned. It was had a single message, a single group of people. They were disciplined. They probably had all kinds of contingency plans in place. And it's propaganda of the deed. And I don't have any real quarrels with it. I don't know what their calculation is in terms of possible benefits and things like that. It's risky. It's definitely risky because if these things go well, we all are happy about it. And then we forget about it pretty promptly. If things go badly, 4 years later, we're finally getting the multi-million dollar judgments handed down after people's lives have been consumed by lawfare.
Right.
Given the potential downsides and the potential upsides and comparing the two, I wouldn't undertake this kind of stuff.
Well,
and I don't know what their calculus is, though, and I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Greg, do you know how many people it was at the march?
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. And it looked like a sizable amount. Like it looked like more guys than showed up to Unite the Right.
Oh, well, no, I don't even think there were 150 people there.
Okay.
There were many, I don't think there were 1,000 people who showed up at Unite the Right, but there were 5 or 6 times as many.
Okay. That's just because maybe I was overestimating it because they were wearing a uniform. But, you know, just think about if you got those guys together working on a business, you know, working on some sort of a financial endeavor together, they could potentially be very successful, you know. So, you know, we need to be getting our guys thinking about things like that. You know, if you can collectivize to march, then you can collectivize to do other things as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can. If you can collectivize to march, you can collectivize to do other things. You can collectivize to do things like build houses for one another. You know, like the Amish do, raise barns for a young couple who are getting started. That kind of stuff would make that community very attractive to other people and give them an edge in a world where there is systematic anti-whiteness at work, trying to basically harm white people and cripple them and sabotage them from the cradle to the grave. So that's the kind of community we definitely need. So we are basically at an end here. Let me just see if there are some more DLive tokens here. Philosopher, yes. Critiqued has donated 1 diamond. Philosopher, 1, 2, 3 diamonds. I really very much appreciate that. I am going to check one more time at Entropy to see if there are any more questions there. Folks, I think we basically wrapped it up. So let's say goodnight in a minute. Carl, I want to thank you for coming on. Can you tell folks how they can follow you and what they should be doing to get the basics of crypto?
Yeah, I'm on Telegram. My address is t.me/BitcoinCarl, all one word, Carl with a K. And you can actually look me up on Countercurrents. If you go to countercurrents and search in the search tab for Carl Thorburn or just Carl T, it will show the articles I've written. I think I've written 4 articles on there now. And one of the articles explains how to get started in Bitcoin. But there's also people you can follow on Twitter that I respect a lot who are into Bitcoin and explain it pretty well. But yeah, if you just go to my Telegram channel, I explain it well there.
Great, great. Thank you so much. Tomorrow, Nick Gilvey is going to be on the writer's block. The writer's block starts at 1 p.m. Pacific time, 4 p.m. Eastern time, and 10 p.m. Central European time. Nick is going to have on HAPA perspective. And of course, he's going to be talking about current events, white identity politics, and your questions. So please do tune in tomorrow for Nick and HAPA perspective on the writer's block. I want to thank everybody who's out there listening now. Thanks, Carl, for coming on. Thank you for the moderators. Thank you for the donors. And we will be back in another week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio.